the time of year when the class of 2016 is celebrating graduating, but also worrying about what's next.
I personally am optimistic, but I know some of my friends who are going into other careers, I know that they're not teaching for sure. And one of my friends is a psych major, and so she has no idea what she's going to do with hers just in the market today.
Today on the 21st, we hear from economists, journalists, and those students about the job outlook for this year's college graduates. We also hear about one group that's not too worried, the millennial 1%. Yes, that's a thing. Also, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is getting involved after last weekend's massive security line problems at Chicago's major airports.
I'm calling on the major airlines to waive their checked baggage fees during the peak summer travel months. They can help us solve this problem.
Also, how our clean water means more gnats this year. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Studying mechanical engineering. I'm actually a senior about to graduate. I had a lot of experience, so I knew I was going to get a job eventually. I wasn't too worried about it.
My major, it's not good. I have to go to grad school.
There are just no jobs for you?
Nothing that'll be high paying or nothing that'll get the return that I want for the work I've put in.
I would really like to work for a nonprofit company, but it's a lot harder than I anticipated. It's really competitive. There actually aren't a lot of job openings.
I personally am optimistic, but I know some of my friends who are going into other careers. I know that they're not teaching for sure. And one of my friends is a psych major, and so she has no idea what she's going to do with hers just in the market today.
Very stressful, especially when a lot of your friends have jobs and stuff lined up and you're scrambling to find something. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Those were University of Illinois students weighing in on what they think their job prospects are. Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that. Today, we're giving you the job outlook for the class of 2016. In one sense, the future looks bright. Employers are estimated to hire about 5% more graduates from the class of 2016 than last year. That's according to the National Association of Colleges and Employers. But a recent report from the Economic Policy Institute paints a stark picture for the entire millennial generation, one of the hardest hit age groups coming out of the recession. Joining me now from Washington is the author of that report, senior researcher Elise Gould. Elise, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So as I mentioned, that recent report shows how many more new grads are being hired this year compared to last year. Across the board, I wonder if you can give us a sense of what kind of labor market this year's graduates are going into, whether that's high school or college, across for all of them.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, what they're saying, that rings true to me as well, that things have definitely improved. So we're seeing the prospects for the class of 2016 better than their, let's say, older brothers and sisters that graduated closer to the Great Recession and those first couple of years in the recovery. Things are definitely doing better, but we're still not back to the economy of 2007, and we're far from the economy or the job prospects for those recent grads back in 2000 when things were looking much better for them.
If you're a new college graduate or if you're a parent of a college graduate, you can give us a call to share your story. We also want to hear from employers. Are you hiring new graduates? Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. As I mentioned, I'm speaking with Elise Gould from Washington. She's a senior economist and director of health policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. In studio with me as well is Eliza Forsythe. She's an assistant professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Eliza, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
As we're thinking about Illinois in particular, and I'm thinking about Illinois being tied with West Virginia right now for having the second highest unemployment rate in the country, not great statistics. That's March Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates. I was wondering if you can tell us how you think the unemployment rate here might affect Illinois graduates if they're looking to stay in the state.
Right. So one thing that's happened over the last few months in Illinois is that the unemployment rate, unfortunately, has ticked up a little bit. And anytime the unemployment rate is higher, it's going to mean it's harder for people to find jobs. And especially from my research, I find young workers and new college graduates are especially affected by that.
Elise, as we're thinking about that and we're thinking about Illinois in particular, when you look at it nationally and we're looking at particularly college graduates, do people tend to stay where they graduate from college or people kind of going anywhere to find wherever the jobs are?
That's a great question. Our paper doesn't deal with that directly, but it certainly is the case that, you know, Illinois looks like many other states across the country where there's still elevated unemployment rates, elevated, for those young workers under 25, when you specifically hit college grads, you know, you have an elevated unemployment, elevated underemployment, so people that are working in jobs that they, you know, would like to be working full-time and they're not, or you think about many college graduates who are working in jobs that don't actually require a college degree when they'd like to be using their college degree and they're not really finding a job that uses those skills.
Well, I think the interesting point about your report is also, regardless of how good the economy is, young high school graduates and college graduates of color, there are certain groups that have a really tough time. And I wanted you to start, I wonder if you could talk particularly about young high school graduates and what the job market is looking for them if they're graduating from high school, not planning on going to college. That's probably a pretty tough labor situation right now, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the unemployment rate right now for high school graduates, those recent high school graduates, so, you know, just like 4 years outside, compared to the college graduates, like, again, 3 or 4 years after graduation, it's much higher for high school graduates. We're talking about an unemployment rate of close to 18%, whereas it's about 5.5% for college graduates. So absolutely, while we've seen the economy recover, and it has recovered to some extent for these high school graduates, they have just very elevated unemployment rates. We're comparing that, again, so we're saying almost 18% compared to about 16% back in 2007, or compared to a much better economy in 2000 of 12%.
Mm-hmm. So that gap really has stayed pretty wide in the past 15 years.
Yes, absolutely. And those high school graduates are absolutely doing much worse. And again, you mentioned workers of color, those young graduates of color, they're also faring much worse than college graduates overall or their white peers. When we think about what the black college graduate unemployment rate is now, it has recovered to a great extent, but it's still worse now than it was for white college graduates when it was the worst in the aftermath of the recession.
So what kind of rates are we thinking about for black college graduates?
So it's 9.4% today compared to the worst of it for white college graduates, the worst that it hit during the Great Recession, the aftermath was 9%. So black college graduates are still not doing as well as the white college graduates were doing in the worst. So they have much higher rates of unemployment. And it's troubling because you're thinking about these new young college graduates or comparing even men and women. You think about, okay, they have the same amount of education. They have about the same amount of experience by definition. And yet you're seeing that they're unemployed at much higher levels. You're seeing that women's wages are much lower than men's wages. There are gaps persist across the economy.
For women, for college graduates of color, yeah, it's almost like you can't have this conversation without looking at specific pockets. And I also think you can't have this conversation without looking at specific industries. And before we get to specific college industries, Elise, I wanted to ask you about what the prospects are for people graduating from vocational or technical colleges. Is that a much better market than maybe we saw a couple years ago?
You know, we don't look at that so much in the paper. I think it's interesting when you think about people without a bachelor's degree or people with some college who haven't finished. I mean, to some extent, their prospects, are better than high school graduates, but not as good as for college graduates. And unfortunately, what happens with many people who don't finish that college degree is they wind up burdened with the debt of college, but without the payoff in terms of higher wages and better job prospects.
What industries are faring the best when you're looking at college graduates now?
I don't have data on specific industries on these for these recent college grads, so I can't answer that question specifically, but it is certainly the case that with a college degree, you're doing much better than mm-hmm. those that don't have a college degree.
Mm-hmm. And let's then get to sort of the broader economy. And I know, Eliza, this is research you've done as well, looking at what sort of the effect of the Great Recession on millennials, right? Because one of the most telling paragraphs from your report, Elise, is saying how many young graduates, it's left neither young graduates neither employed nor in college. And Eliza, I wanted to ask you about the research you've done about looking back, how would you say someone who graduated in 2008 differ from someone who graduated a year ago, say 5 years down the road? How different are the job markets and how compared?
Sure. So people that graduated sort of in the depth of the Great Recession, they had a lot harder time finding jobs to begin with. The jobs that they were able to find were sort of lower paying, lower quality jobs. And the other thing that was really a problem was they had a lot harder of time moving between jobs. So for young workers, it's really important to build your career to be able to make these movements between firms. That's an important source of earnings growth. But during recessions, these movements kind of grind to a halt. And so young workers ended up kind of getting stuck. So I think people that are graduating more recently, they're not facing quite the same challenges. But because the labor market is still a little bit weak, they don't have the same opportunities, say, as in 2000, as they would have been able to move up really quickly to better quality jobs.
And Elise, when we're thinking about that, when you're graduating it's almost like you're graduating at a disadvantage because you're graduating we're talking about, I think people tend to think, well, you're graduating, do you find a job? But I think your research and Eliza's research makes the point that you also enter into the industry at a wage rate that ends up affecting you later on. Can you explain that a little bit more, Elise?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely true that the workers who graduated more immediately after the recession had a harder time than workers do today, those young workers entering. But even today, you're going to have long-lasting effects of graduating in a softer economy on your wages today and on your wages for many years to come. Just your career trajectory is going to be affected by graduating into a worse labor market. You know, one of the things we often think of with high school graduates or college graduates when they're deciding whether or not to enter the labor force at that point, you know, and looking at their job prospects is you think, okay, well, maybe this is a good opportunity to go back to school. You know, maybe I can go back to school and get that degree, maybe go to grad school if you're a college graduate, maybe go to college if you're a high school graduate, and spend that time, you know, waiting out the recession in school. And what we found is that was not the case, either because of the expense of going back to school or going to school in the first place, or, you know, other demands that we did not see that happening. So you did not see a big increase in enrollment rates among high school and college graduates that you might expect. You know, what we in fact do see is that there are a growing number, and it has improved, again, over the past few years has improved, but still elevated compared to 2007, of high school and college graduates idling. So idling, we're saying that they're neither enrolled in higher education nor are they employed. And so that's a troubling phenomenon.
Well, and I wonder, as we're thinking about all of that, in particular, Eliza, would you say for someone who graduated within the recession, are they doing better now? Or do you think their skills, like, so if someone graduated within the recession, would they do better by the time the recession was over?
So I haven't looked at that specifically, but, you know, other research has shown that over time, prospects do improve for workers that graduated during recession. So they're disadvantaged, but they are able to make up some of those losses.
Well, and it's a really interesting thing too, at least what you're saying about the conventional wisdom is we tend to think people will hide out in school or will. But are we thinking that that's changing now because of the amount of college loans and people are just thinking it's too expensive of a bet to hedge?
That could be the case. It could be that they're looking at college loans. It could be the fact that the recession also affected their parents, right? And so their family's ability to send them to school may be different just because they may be also, you know, disadvantaged. Maybe one of their parents lost a job or maybe their house was underwater because of, you know, that crash at the same time. So there could be many different factors that are leading to that. But you might expect to see that increase, again, of, you know, you said hiding out or sheltering in school. And we just did not see any more of an increase than we have seen secular, you know, just because more people are going to college generally. You didn't see any sort of bump up there.
Mm-hmm. And then what do we know about folks who graduated during the recession? I know there's sort of this big group of millennials. Do we know what kind of jobs they have? Are people kind of cobbling together a couple different jobs as opposed to a full-time career? What does the research show about that?
That certainly is the case. Generally, you do see that in recessions, you see that people are going to piece together different part-time jobs, try to just make ends meet. You do see an increasing number of people with a college degree working in jobs that don't require a college degree, so that is an active phenomenon as well that is troubling and unfortunate for those college graduates who are hoping to use their skills. So I think that's difficult. I mean, I think one of the interesting things to think about also is What are firms doing now? Are they overlooking those graduates from, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago who have been working in jobs that didn't necessarily use their skills and they want to now enter those fields? Are firms going to look at them, or are they going to just try to look at those college graduates of this year? And so there's a question of, you know, what is going on there? I think it'd be great to get that perspective.
Yeah, that's it. Well, we haven't talked about the employer side as well. And Eliza, I wanted to ask you that. I wonder what we see when we think about companies, if we think they're being short-sighted, particularly during a recession, if they're not even looking at hiring younger workers at all, whether they're 5 years out or recent grads.
Right. So one of the things my research shows is that during recessions, firms choose to hire more experienced workers. And I think that's because there's a lot more people that are applying to their jobs and they can be choosy and hire the people that have relevant work experience. They don't have to train them. But that does sort of end up leaving young workers who didn't have the opportunity to get that work experience. They're kind of left in the cold. And so that's what my research shows. There's some other research that looks at job postings, and they showed that during the Great Recession, firms increased sort of the experience required in job postings. So you needed to have 2 years previous experience, 5 years, and that hasn't necessarily come down. So if these workers weren't in the industry or the jobs that they wanted to be in during the Great Recession and they haven't managed to move in, they might still be having trouble moving into the occupations or industries that they would like to be in.
That's Eliza Forsythe. She teaches in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. We're also speaking with Elise Gould, a senior economist and director of health policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with someone from the class of 2016. And later in the show, we're going to hear about a small portion of this age group that's not worried at all about all of this. That's the millennial 1%. You're listening to The 21st. If you're a recent grad, you can share with us if you're excited or terrified. If you're a parent of one, you can share your story. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to The 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. More than two-thirds of 2016 college graduates surveyed in a recent poll said they chose their major because they were passionate about the subject area. In that same Accenture poll, even more of those students said they took into account the availability of jobs in their field before choosing a major. Today on The 21st, we're talking about what their prospects look like now that they're graduating. If you're a new college graduate or a parent of one, give us a call. We also want to hear from employers. Are you hiring new graduates? Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. My guests with me in studio, Eliza Forsythe, teaches in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Joining us on the line from Washington, from the Economic Policy Institute, Elise Gould is a senior economist there. And I wanted to ask both of you, Elise, the report that you all did looks at sort of the investment that students make in a college degree. And do you feel like that payoff, when we're thinking about, as everyone's sort of thinking about the loans and the equation, and that's so much of a conversation about debt and earning potential, how do you feel about that calculus, if it's still, from an economic standpoint, worth it to invest in a college degree?
Well, obviously, it matters very much on an individual basis, and people get many different things out of college than necessarily the higher wages, more work flexibility, autonomy. There are many different things besides all the connections that you get going to college. And so a family's economic situation needs to weigh all of those different things. But it is certainly the case that college has increased in price faster than wages have increased, and the college high school premium, so how much more you earn, let's say, per hour with a college degree, has not appreciably improved in the last dozen years or so. And to the extent that it has at all, it's because high school wages have actually been dragging. So I think there's many different factors that you want to really weigh in when you're making that decision.
It sounds like you're saying, though, it's not as worth it as it was in the past. Is that accurate?
I think it depends on what
industry you're going into.
Yeah, because, I mean, wages haven't been growing so much as they have in the past. So I think that for high school and college graduates, it's really been pretty weak.
Eliza, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think a college degree is one of the most reliable ways for people to improve their earnings potentials as long as you're able to finish it and find a job. And so I think, you know, there might be choices that you make in terms of which major you go into that could affect the outcomes. But even if the you know, return hasn't been improving, it's still a really great return.
Well, and Elise, I wonder how much of you think from a policy standpoint, the notion of college debt is really more of a policy question that should be resolved as opposed to something that is every kind of everybody in their students being burdened with that and thinking about how much they have to pay and weighing that into the calculus as well.
Right. I mean, I think that when we think about college debt, we're thinking about making sure that people across the income distribution have an opportunity to go to college. Right, that's sort of what America is based on, that economic opportunity where it's not really there, but we want to increase that. We also want to make sure that our high-achieving students that may come from poorer backgrounds have the opportunity to achieve in our country, not only for themselves, but also for the country as a whole. And I think that, you know, another thing we talked about earlier was about those more marginalized workers. So people of color that are graduating into the economy today having much worse outcomes, women having worse outcomes than men. I think one of the number one things we can really do to improve that is to get to full employment, to get to an economy like we saw in the late 90s where it really pulls in people across the economy back into the economy and you see true wage growth for many people. So I think that, you know, that is one of the things we need to do, not only for younger workers but for the economy as a whole, and it will pull those younger workers into the economy in a more meaningful way and give them better outcomes.
Well, and Elise, this is a really tough question given our current presidential election year and all the other unknowns that are factoring into the economy. But what do you think remains to be done? What do you think is the best thing to happen in the next 12 months for the American economy for us to think about achieving full employment?
Well, I think for sure we need to have the Federal Reserve Board prioritizing that low rate of unemployment when making their monetary policy, and they shouldn't raise interest rates prematurely, which will slow the economy down. We need to really push the boundaries on how far we can get the unemployment level, the unemployment rate to go, because we still see it's elevated for many different groups, and we need it to come down to really see those groups see the advantages of a growing economy.
Eliza, do you think the classes who graduated in recession will ever be able to pull even, or is it dependent on what Elise is saying about us achieving full employment and that will help sort of wages and everything else?
So definitely sort of the most advantaged people that graduate during recessions, they're able to kind of recover. The question is definitely for the sort of the more marginalized kids, for sure. But it's hard to say.
Thanks for that. That's Eliza Forsyth. She teaches in the school. She's an assistant professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. I want to thank also Elise Gould, a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Eliza, Elise, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
We wanted to turn the conversation as well to recent college graduates and actually speak to them. So joining us right now is Christopher Heller, who graduated from the University of Illinois in May in agriculture. He's on the phone with us from Mattoon. Hey, Christopher, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. How are we doing?
Good. So congratulations. You're doing great, right? Because you're about to end your second internship and start a full-time job. Can you tell us what your job is going to be?
Yeah, I'm going to accepted a job with AgriLiant Genetics. I will go on as a sales trainee with them, and I start Monday with that.
Great. How important do you think your internships were to helping land a full-time job?
Well, I think the internships were crucial. You get good networking opportunities. You get to meet people within the company. And then when it comes time for applying for jobs, you know, if they see the name, they know, and they can put a face to it, and they know your work ethic, it makes you stand out above others that may be on their list. So I think that was a great thing that helped me get to where I am.
Christopher, when you graduated from high school, I know that ag was in this middle of really high grain prices, and I wonder how much that motivated you to picking crop sciences as your major.
Sure, we had a good run there for a while, and nobody was really scared to get into the industry at that time. When I was looking at it, it was kind of taken off, and it looked very promising over the next five, you know, years. So it definitely helped. I think I would have been in it regardless, just for true passion that I have for it.
Right, because right now we're seeing not such the commodities market obviously is not in the situation it was a couple years ago. But for you, this was being in ag was a decision you made regardless of the economy, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would have been in this position regardless, but very fortunate that I went to the U of I and got a great degree in crop sciences and helped me get to here. So,
Christopher, what steps did you take during college to ensure that you would be at this point now, that you have a job secured now right after graduation?
I took, a good amount of diverse classes within crop sciences, and also I have a minor in food and farm management. And so I think the classes really helped set me up well, and then being able to use that information in my internships to kind of present myself that I am knowledgeable and in the field and can handle myself, as well as leadership opportunities. I was the president of Field and Furrow, the agronomy club, and I think that experience really helped a lot.
And so did you feel like you needed to be diversified within ag to kind of cover your bets, or is that part of it? Sounds like a little bit what you did in your 4 years while you were at the U of I.
Yeah, the farming industry is so diverse that, a farmer has to make so many decisions on agronomically and weather and marketing, and, they make a lot of decisions. So the more well-rounded I was able to educate myself, I thought the better I'd be able to connect with other growers and make better impressions through that.
Christopher, would you say you're better off than your classmates who also graduated with you, or is everyone you know about to start work or maybe graduate school?
I think in the crop science department, there's so many opportunities for internships, and there's a lot of job opportunities in the ag industry. I'd say that, starts out at a pretty even point, and I think there's a lot of potential for our generation to grow and move up the ladder if the opportunity presents itself.
Well, congratulations, and thanks for joining us. From Mattoon, Christopher Heller, who starts his job next week. Thanks, Christopher.
Thank you.
Joining us now from Chicago is Robert Weil. He covers business and economics for Fusion. And talking about moving into that ladder, Robert's been doing some reporting on one group, the Millennial 1%. Hey, Robert, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, good to be with you.
Before we get to that 1%, I want to talk about, and we've kind of covered, we've talked about this group a little bit this hour as we're thinking about millennials and the job outlook. And you've reported that there's some 28 million people between the ages of 18 and 34 who are neither going to school nor earning more than $10,000 a year. From your reporting, what is this in this population? What are people doing?
That's a good question. They're most likely being supported by their parents in some way. They're possibly part of the gig economy where, we have seen that the official numbers sometimes don't pick up these people, even though they are earning some income. They're not listed officially as employed because they're not filing the standard employment forms, but the majority are still in school. We're also just seeing people stay in school basically until they're 30 years old often, and it's just taking longer and longer for people to for younger people to join the workforce.
Yeah, when you say gig economy, what do you mean by that?
Right. It really has an expansive definition these days. Obviously, the first things that come to mind are Uber.
Right. So sort of like the informal economy, the sharing economy, kind of that kind of work, like maybe the modern day equivalent of that.
That's right. But Uber is actually tends to be sort of older males. The way I would describe it would be, sort of people picking up freelancing gigs and selling stuff that they've made online, where they're not really, employed by any one organization, but that doesn't mean that they're, not earning any income.
Right. So let's go to the opposite end of this, the millennial 1%. And maybe we should also, how are you defining millennial, by the way?
Yeah, so we actually, for when we put out our study of the Millennial 1% calculator, we took a pretty expansive definition. We used anyone between the ages of 18 to 34, so that included people, you know, young kids in college. So that skewed our numbers a little bit low, where, you know, if you're in school, just entering school, you're probably not going to be, unless you're in a work study program, you're not going to be earning that much money. But nevertheless, we did find groups that were, you know, out earning their peers by a significant amount.
And how much is a significant amount? What is it? What income do you need to qualify to be in the millennial 1%?
So we found that about $125,000 a year in annual income qualifies you as the 1%.
Wow. Okay. And what kind of jobs are we talking about for these people who are coming out of, who are recent graduates or very new graduates who are making these six-figure salaries?
Yeah. So this is actually, you know, you might think it's like sort of LeBron James or someone who's sort of like hit the lottery, although obviously LeBron is making much more than that.
He's into good seven or eight figures, right?
Yeah. But the main thing is they've sort of made a bargain with their finances, which is that they're in professions where they likely have taken on a lot of debt. So even though they are earning a lot, they are carrying a lot of debt with them. So the two obvious ones that would come to mind are lawyers and doctors. And in order to work their way up to the tippy top of the income scale, they've had to borrow a lot of money to get there. So if you dug into those numbers further, you would find that, yes, they are earning a lot more, but they're also carrying sort of expansive debt loads.
And Robert, I wanted to ask you, in general, you guys at Fusion have done a lot of surveys of millennials. How optimistic is this generation despite having kind of these varying degrees of income earning potential across the board?
That's a good question. I think it sort of varies, but everyone does tend to be optimistic, sort of for some of the reasons that your previous guest mentioned, which is that this is the most educated generation sort of ever. And, you know, everyone is being told or they've heard throughout their youth that, you know, as long as they get a college degree, they'll sort of be financially secure. So they still have that sort of in their minds. Now, the one sort of caveat to that is how much education do you need? And, you know, more and more people are finding that, okay, well, I have my bachelor's, but I'm stuck in a job that probably doesn't need a bachelor's, so now I have to go get my master's. And then now that I have my master's, I'm in a job that maybe probably would have only required a bachelor's a few years ago. So there's sort of, I guess, a diminishing returns effect going on. But to sum up, generally optimistic, but you know, we'll see where the economy goes in the next few years to see.
Yeah. Robert, I wanted to just ask you about one completely, this is completely different apart from millennials, but I saw this morning you were tweeting out about recent BLS data about how much the unemployment rate for foreign-born workers has declined, and actually it's dropped almost 1.5% in the past 2 years. And I know that's a big group when the BLS is looking at foreign-born workers because they're including workers who have documentation to work here as well as workers who do, people who are here without legal authorization to be working in this country. But I wanted to ask you in particular about young people in that group, if that might be a bright spot.
It is a bright spot in some sense. I mean, the numbers for the unemployment numbers for foreign-born population is always lower than the native-born, and the simple reason is they have less access to government programs that would allow them to sort of be take time off to look for a job with higher wages or one that they are more that's more their liking, basically. So that's always been the case. So the other thing that's going on there, though, is that we are creating lots and lots of low-wage jobs. I mean, we are also creating lots of high-wage jobs.
Right.
The middle ground is the one that's disappearing.
Thanks for that, Robert. Yeah. We could do a whole other show just on the low-wage jobs, which we will do later on. But thanks for that. Robert Weil is a reporter for Fusion covering millennial economics. Coming up, an update on the TSA fiasco at Midway and O'Hare. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This morning, TSA officials did some demonstrations for reporters at Midway Airport about how to get through security lines faster. That's the latest from the agency that's been slammed by passengers, airlines, and government officials over the long lines that have caused thousands to miss flights out of Chicago's major airports in the past few weeks. It's even spawned a hashtag, I hate the wait. Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin earlier this week asked TSA to increase the number of officials at Chicago airports.
We've all seen the footage, the long lines of people waiting to go through security screening at O'Hare and Midway. Folks are getting angry. They're missing their planes. Some are staying overnight. Well, let's put this in perspective. Our highest priority is protecting the safety of passengers. But poor planning and inadequate funding have really led to these long lines and unreasonable delays at airports across the country, but particularly in Chicago. That's why I stepped into this personally, to see what we can do to move things.
Senator Durbin says the Department of Homeland Security is committing 58 additional TSA officers and K-9 units to Chicago airports. But he also says part of the problem is the airlines, and he's called on airlines to suspend checked baggage fees for the busy summer travel season.
More and more passengers are carrying their bags on. That means going through security. So I'm calling on the major airlines to waive their checked baggage fees during the peak summer travel months. They can help us solve this problem. I'm going to convene a meeting with state and local officials and the airlines this week to ensure everybody's on the same page about fixing this problem as quickly as possible.
So here's what we've got from the airlines. United Airlines has said that they are speaking, they're working collaboratively with the TSA every day, particularly at our hubs in Newark and Chicago, to address longer than wait times at some security airports. And they're saying we encourage customers to allow plenty of time in their travel schedule. Not yet word on what's going to go on with those baggage fees. By the way, that meeting Senator Durbin was talking about includes TSA head Peter Neffinger. That's going to be happening in Chicago tomorrow. American Airlines says that between February and last week, more than 3,800 passengers flying from O'Hare missed their flights because of long TSA security lines. And then in other cases, the carriers had to delay flights, which has a ripple effect on their overall operations. Senator Mark Kirk has also spoken out on this issue. He said that Neffinger should resign if this issue isn't resolved by Memorial Day. We've been talking about water issues lately and focusing quite a bit on lead on the 21st. Last night, Governor Rauner announced that the state of Illinois will loan the city of Galesburg $4 million to replace its lead service lines. That will allow Galesburg, which has had repeated problems with lead in its water systems, to replace nearly half of its total lead lines. While technically it's a loan, the city's not going to have to pay back the $4 million, just the interest. The governor's office has said Illinois' EPA, which is the agency facilitating the loans, anticipates this is just the first of several additional lead line service replacement projects. We've been covering this issue, as I said, on the 21st. If you head to our website, 21stshow.org, you can see the past shows we've done all this. And continuing on water news, with all the bad news about water, we do know that the context of this is that the water in Illinois is much cleaner now than it was decades ago. And the good news, bad news part of this is that the unfortunate downside of clean water means more bugs, in particular, more gnats. If you have noticed this, as I did, as I was walking around Champaign yesterday and walking into swarms of gnats. Joining us in studio to talk about this phenomenon is Phil Nixon. He's an entomologist with the University of Illinois Extension. Hey, Phil, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
How does it work that clean water means more gnats?
Well, it's some types of gnats. It's primarily buffalo gnats, which we've had a problem with biting usually in the early part of June. And I actually found one specimen last night. It made the mistake of flying into the corner of my eye, which is a stupid thing for a bug to do.
Especially to an entomologist.
Yes.
Did you just pick it out right
just
away?
Picked it out and identified it, yes.
What's a buffalo gnat? What's the difference?
Buffalo gnat larvae live in streams of water. They need fast-flowing water to live in. And they feed with mouth fans that collect the debris in the water. And these actually get clogged up easily or can be burned by pollutants. And so they only survive in nice, clear streams. And so people who go to, say, the Boundary Waters or somewhere very commonly have those around because of the cleaner water. And due to the Clean Water Act and other types of legislation, as well as people just changing their attitude, you do not throw things away in water anymore. These insects are becoming more numerous, along with some other insects that tend to be more of a nuisance than a biting pest.
So when you were growing up, these kind of gnats were not necessarily an issue.
No, I never saw one growing up.
And now, what are we looking at populations now compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago of these?
Well, we've had situations where, particularly in the more of the Springfield area and north towards Jacksonville and down towards Belleville area and so on, areas where the gnats, buffalo gnats, become so numerous that they feed on birds' blood as well as human and other mammals, and they became so numerous that underneath the wings that they were killing poultry, chickens. We had a bluebird trail out by Jacksonville, which was pretty well decimated. All the baby birds were killed by buffalo gnats inside the nest boxes.
Oh, no.
We had some emus get killed by them getting underneath their wings. For people, they're more of a nuisance as far as they will feed on us. But for poultry, they can be a serious problem.
And so for poultry farmers in particular, I imagine this is something they're having to contend with. How are they dealing with it?
Well, what we recommend is that buffalo gnats like to bite out in the sunshine. And so if they've got a shed they can get into, and preferably a screened one that the buffalo gnats can't follow them in, that's primarily what they're able to do.
And if you're not raising chickens or kind of in the bird industry in some way, how should people who aren't in that handle the gnat situation?
Well, what we can do is we can put on repellents containing DEET, and that's going to be most of your common brand names, such as Cutters or Off, is going to be effective associated with that.
Is it true that you can also make your own solution of half vanilla and half water, and if you spray that around, will that keep gnats away?
It works for some people. It doesn't work for others. In fact, for some people, depending on their genetics, it actually attracts the insects to them.
I feel like that would be me because I have the, I think I'm that 1% of the population that mosquitoes always go to as well. You know, when they've done research on people who mosquitoes swarm to, and that's mm-hmm. definitely me. I wanted to ask you on the mosquitoes front. The House just passed a $622 million Zika bill. Do you think that this year in particular with mosquitoes, should we be much more concerned about that when we're kind of thinking about on the bug front this summer, what we should be worried about?
Particularly associated with it in the southern part of the United States, the yellow fever mosquito, the mosquito that transmits Zika virus the best, occurs south of Illinois, maybe in the far south parts of Illinois, perhaps a little bit. We have Asian tiger mosquito in most of Illinois south of Peoria. It can transmit Zika virus as well, but once those mosquitoes become numerous and people come in with Zika virus, it will start being transmitted. So, yes, we need to be aware of it. It can cause birth defects, microcephaly in babies. More than are born with that will die in the womb. That's not getting through in the news media much. And then adults can suffer paralysis for several weeks from this virus. So most people will not be bothered severely by it, but it is something we need to be aware of and be on top of, particularly in the southern third of the United States.
And I think it's important for people to realize that mosquitoes and gnats actually need different types of water to grow, right? Because gnats grow in clean water. That's not the case for mosquitoes, right?
It depends on the mosquito. Oh, we have floodwater mosquitoes, the ones that will drive you inside with all the bites that were common throughout Illinois and we always figure of the first of it is Memorial Day weekend. They like clean water. They're in floodwater conditions, whereas the disease-carrying mosquitoes, both for West Nile virus and for Zika, they're different mosquito species, but both of them are container breeding, preferring putrid water. Essentially, if you've seen water sitting in an old tin can or in an old
knock
tire and about knocked you over when you took a whiff, that's what those mosquitoes really like. Clogged gutters, these sorts of things.
So for people, we need to think about, especially this summer, given concerns about Zika, you really just want to make sure you don't have standing water and those sorts of things in your yard or around.
And if you are noticing mosquitoes out, the ones that transmit Zika virus are day-biting mosquitoes. And so wearing repellent outside if you're noticing mosquitoes around would be an important thing. But yes, we're very much in control. The mosquitoes that transmit both West Nile virus and Zika virus are not far flyers. And so your neighborhood is where you're getting those bites from. And if you can keep things cleaned up in your yard and nearby, help with neighbors' situations, that will pretty well be the best protection. Prevention is the best case here.
We're talking with entomologist Phil Nixon about gnats and mosquitoes and bugs here on the 21st. And when we're thinking about gnats, I wanted to just ask you again about the difference in the amount of gnats, what it was like for you growing up as a kid. Did you see these swarms? Yesterday, I saw lots of swarms kind of just walking around.
We saw the swarms that when I was growing up because also out there besides the buffalo gnats are also eye gnats. And these are the ones that seem to be flying around, the little ones flying around and bothering us as much as anything.
And obviously eye gnats are the ones that get in your eye.
And they get in your eyes, although the one that got in my eye was a buffalo gnat. It was a different one. But the eye gnats and fungus gnats, which will make the large masses of gnats hanging around in the air, they actually, their larvae feed in wet, decaying organic matter. And so that's always been around. And the more rain we have in the spring, generally the more of these types of gnats we have. So probably the eye gnat problem we're seeing right now is more due to all the rainfall we've been having more than anything else.
What's going on with this freaks me out, the swarms. What's going on when they're all swarming when you're walking through there?
This is essentially how male gnats attract ladies to them. They all gang together and make this big mass of hovering gnats, and that's as attractive to the females of the species. And when they decide to mate, they essentially fly into the mass, and literally one gets lucky.
So that's what's happening in the swarm. So
these
should not be
mats.
Walking through the
these
swarm.
These are male mats going out there saying, hey, here I am. You know, I'm pretty nice looking. Look at our nice swarm. Wouldn't you come in and visit for a while? You know, that sort of thing.
And as they're populating in those swarms, are we at the level, earlier you were saying, particularly with the buffalo gnats and how that's affecting poultry, is this something where we're at a level where municipalities and other governments are thinking about gnat control on the level we do with mosquito control? Or are we not at that point with the population?
No, we're not really at that point. It's more of a localized situation that people should be responding with repellents themselves. Obviously, the last thing in the world we want to do is pollute waters that have now become more pristine that we can eat fish out of and things of this nature. So obviously, we do not want to go backwards in time. We just need to learn how to cope and live with this, and changing our habits slightly, we can cope with this. The buffalo gnats are only out for about 2 or 3 weeks, typically
in
June.
Is it earlier this year because of the rain?
It appears to be starting a little bit earlier. There are various species of buffalo gnats. Many of them do not bite people or the poultry. They'll feed on other types of mammals, things of this nature. And probably the one that flew into my eye last night was actually a different species than would bite, because we're not seeing any of these biting. So the biting ones haven't shown up yet. Typically, they show up around the first part of June.
And how long does that last? Is that
about
a couple weeks? Okay. And I think it's also important for people to know, in general, unlike mosquitoes, gnats are not necessarily transmitting illnesses.
That's correct. Particularly the buffalo gnats are not going to transmit. The eye gnats actually transmit pink eye in cattle, but pink eye in humans are transmitted more by physical contact.
Oh, okay. Are there any other bugs we should be worried about this time of year?
No, that's about it. As far as things that really bug you personally, yes.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That's Phil Nixon. He's an entomologist with the University of Illinois Extension with the Department of Crop Sciences, giving us the latest update on bugs, particularly gnats and mosquitoes. Thanks a lot, Phil.
Glad to be here.
That does it for the 21st today. You can always find us on NPR One, by the way. If you want to find past episodes, you can search for the 21st. That'll give you access to all of our past shows. If you're a podcast user on iTunes or Android, you can find all of those links to our website, 21stshow.org. We always welcome feedback on the show. You can email us. Our address is talk@21stshow.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. You can tweet to us. All of this information, so you don't have to remember, is on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is produced by Christine Herman, Austin Keating, and Travis Stansel. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. On tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about baseball and a new documentary that's premiering on the Big Ten Network tomorrow night with the University of Illinois' Adrian Burgos. So that's tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening.